Alan Shepard was the first American in space. In 1961, he rode the space capsule Mercury 7 to an altitude of 115 miles. 10 years later, Shepard commanded the Apollo 14 on a mission to the moon. In between those two space flights, he was grounded for medical reasons. But he helped direct the space program as chief of NASA's astronaut office. He was an essential part of the team that helped America first get to the moon 25 years ago. Last month, I asked him about his first space flight back in 1961. The trip was brief, so we didn't have much time to experiment with weightlessness.
My flight was only 16 minutes. We did have about 5.5 minutes of weightlessness, and the thing which we tried to cram into that 5.5 minutes had to do primarily with my ability to actually control the spacecraft, actually fly it like an airplane. Because we knew that so much of the early days of space depended upon the abilities of a pilot, not only under primary conditions with no casualties, no failures, but also to practice for situations where the pilot would have to take over in order to bring it back in safely. So most of the 5.5 minutes were devoted to my actually controlling the spacecraft and reporting how I was doing and that sort of thing.
How were you doing?
I did great, of course.
I mean, how did it feel to control the spacecraft while being weightless?
Well, it was a tremendous exhilaration, of course, at being up there in the first place. Also, the second place, the fact that everything was going well. And then, lastly, the fact that I flew it exactly as I was supposed to fly it.
You were grounded for several years because of an inner ear problem. And then you were able to be cured through a surgical process that surprised everybody by working and working very well. So then you got to go to the moon, which you'd long wanted to do. But when you took that flight, the Apollo 14, in 1971, February of 1971, you felt that you carried the whole future of the space program with you. Why did your mission have such symbolic import?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story, actually. As soon as I was ungrounded and NASA said, okay, we think you're ready to go, Slayton and I immediately picked a crew and gave me command of Apollo 13. We sent the list to Washington. They said, oh, we can't do that. We said, now, wait a minute, you know, Shepard has been training along with everybody. He's just as bright and just as ready to go as the rest of them. How come? They said, well, it's just too soon. You give us a political problem. Shepard is so well known, and he's been obviously grounded for so many years, and politically, it's just not right. So let's make a deal. Give us another crew for Apollo 13, and we'll let Shepard have 14. So, as you may recall, Apollo 13 took off with Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes and Jack Swigert. They're halfway on the way to the moon, and they had an explosion which blew out the side of the service module, the mothership. It took away all their primary power system, and there they were on the way to the moon without the power to do it. Obviously, they weren't going to be able to land. They used the lunar module power systems to communicate, to help navigate, and with the help of the people on the ground, of course, it did a fantastic job and came back safely. But then the next flight, all of a sudden, is under the gun. It said, well, yeah, we made a couple of landings, but we had an explosion. Do we really need to keep doing this? Don't we have enough rocks the way it is? So there was starting to be criticism of the program as a result of the explosion. Then there was the fact that the two chaps I had chosen to go with me had not flown before, and my buddies didn't give me a heck of a lot of credit for just 16 minutes of space flight, so we were dubbed the three rookies, Apollo 14, the three rookies, and that put a little bit of added interest. It gave us a little bit of additional incentive to absolutely fly the very best flight that had ever been flown before or since. And quite frankly, we came very close to that.
What surprised you most about how the surface of the moon looked?
I don't think we had any surprises about the actual surface of the moon, about the barrenness. We had looked at pictures of our landing site taken by previous missions. We had worked with the models that were made from those pictures. We knew the general configuration of where the craters were supposed to be. We knew the objective of Cone Crater, which was the one we climbed up the side of to get rock samples. There weren't any surprises there. The surprise I had was standing on the surface after we'd been there for a few minutes, having a chance to rest a little bit and looking up at the Earth for the first time. Now, you have to look up because that's where it is. And the sky is totally black, and here you have a planet which is four times the size of the moon as we look at it from the Earth. And then you also have a color. You have a blue oceans and the brown land masses, the brown continents, and you can see ice on the ice caps on the North Pole and so on. And just an absolute incredible view. And then you say, that looks a little small to me. It looks like it does have limits. It's a little fragile. You know, down here we think it's infinite. We don't worry about resources. Up there you're saying, gosh, you know, it's a shame those folks down there can't get along together and think about trying to conserve, to save what limited resources they have. And it was just very, very emotional. I actually shed a couple of tears looking up at the Earth and having those feelings.
One of the things you did on the moon was to hit a couple of golf balls. Where did the golf club come from and the golf balls? And why'd you do it?
Well, I enjoyed the game of golf before I went, and I tried to think of something that would demonstrate the fact we only had 1/6 gravity, which means the ball is going to go 6 times as far for the same club head speed. There's no atmosphere, so the ball is not going to hook or slice. And the time of flight is going to be 6 times as long. So I started thinking about it and very quickly realized that we had a collapsible handle there, aluminum handle, we used with a scoop on the end. And we used that to scoop up samples of dust, and we put them in a little bag and mark the bag and bring it back. We use that because it's very difficult to bend over and get a sample from a virgin dust. But that would have been left up there, so I took a look at it, and it was about the same as the length of a shaft of a number 6 iron. So I got the head of a number 6 and cut it off and put a little fitting, had a pro put a little fitting on it to snap on the end of this club. And I had the club head on the and the 2 golf balls in the pocket of my suit. I had practiced before we went. I got the boss's permission to do it. And at the very end of the mission, when all was completed, I snapped the club head on the handle, tossed the 2 golf balls down in the dust, kind of teed them up a little bit, and took a whack and did it in front of the television camera. So we have a great picture in the book of this ball sailing up and off into the black sky. The suit was kind of cumbersome, and I couldn't swing as hard as I wanted, so it probably would have gone maybe 30, 35 yards with one hand shot here on the Earth, but it went over 200 yards. The time of flight was like 40 seconds. Just an absolute thrill for me to do that. And in the book, you actually see the picture of the golf ball still in the frame, which is kind of cute.
Alan Shepard recorded last month. He co-authored the new book, Moonshot. This is Fresh Air.